So this is going to look a little different than most Sundays. This morning we are having a conversation around indigenous people. I don't normally have my computer in front of me like this, but for those online, I want you to be able to share your questions in the chat space, and so I'm just going to keep this here for that reason. We have a few reasons we're doing it this morning, and I'm actually not going to unpack them all right now. Hopefully they will come out as we engage. But at the heart of it is that we want to better see the image of God in people that we maybe haven't been as good at doing that. And I say we, I mean the church more broadly hasn't been as good at doing that as perhaps we should. And we can't change the church broadly, but we can consider things ourselves. And how do we do that ourselves? Hopefully through that, we will be able to think about how we've been shaped by things and our own life and our own contribution to the world. But at the heart of it is most Sunday mornings, we talk about things pretty broadly. It's challenging sometimes to get into specific applications because we are all living in different contexts, and specific application can lead to misapplication in some context. It misses nuances on things, and the goal is that each of us takes some of what we've talked about, and we got to wrestle with how does this work itself out in my life and my context. But sometimes talking in generalities can lead us to forget that how we live this way of Jesus is not a generalities thing. It shows up in specific, real, concrete ways. And so we're going to talk about something real specific and concrete, partly as a reminder that this is how we engage with all of the way of Jesus. It works itself out in real, specific, concrete ways. This is one of them. But even as we talk about that this morning, there's still a level of generalities that's going to have to be worked out as you go and engage with people and situations and contexts. So we're aware of the limitations of what we have this morning. So I'm glad that Glenn is with us this morning. Glenn Robitaille is the Director of Ethics and Spiritual Care at Waypoint Center for Mental Health Care. That's one of the hats he wears at Waypoint. He wears several. But as well, Glenn is the founding pastor of Covenant Church here. Why don't you just begin by just kind of why are you here? And I know you've got some stuff that you just want to clarify before we start.
Thanks, John. Yes, it's great to be with you today. I know some of you, others I do not know so well. I've been a part of the Mental Health Center Penetang Machine and now Waypoint since the days when I was actually pastoring here. I did a fee-for-service arrangement and provided care while I was there. But to this specific topic, I want to say, first of all, that I do not represent the indigenous community. You know, what I'm sharing is my perspective. I always ask permission from the indigenous community before I speak on things like this, because I can't assume that just because I have experience working with indigenous communities that I have the right to speak on their behalf, and I don't. So what I'm going to share is my own experience, which they have, the community members that I've been able to speak with have generously encouraged me to do. It's something that I do often in various settings. So I just want to say right up front that these are my perceptions, and my experience is based on my interaction with the indigenous community. So some background on that is back in 2004, we launched a position called the Coordinator of Aboriginal Spiritual Services at Waypoint, and it was basically a political thing where the person helped to liaise with the various indigenous communities. And when I took over as director of that program in 2008, I developed and transitioned it to an indigenous healer role, which placed the person more specifically in the realm of the spiritual care. And during my time working with, first of all, a man by the name of Pierre Cascanet, who did the pilot for this program when it was a coordinator's position, and then later mostly with a man named John Rice, He goes by Zabatus Manumni, which is John Rice in Ojibwe most often. I learned a lot about what it means to be indigenous, and I've always known that I have a Métis background. When I did my DNA testing, I found out that I have a whole 2% of that. That's it. But I've always been aware that that's a part of my background, and in interacting with John Rice, I got to know a lot about indigenous spirituality and about the challenges and the needs of indigenous communities. So I'm basically going to be speaking from that background and the opportunity that I've had to sit on the Indigenous Health Circle for our area and to provide trauma support in the local communities when required and things like that.
Great, thanks, Glenn. So the first question I have, just to get us started, is why do you think it's important for us as a church, as a covenant community, to talk about the experiences of Indigenous people, and why in this context instead of some other context? And is it just because we're trying to be cool, like that's what we're taught, people are talking about, so we should do it just to so we can be a part of that, or what's the?
Well, for those of you who were here when I was pastor, you will know that my favorite passage from the Hebrew Scriptures is from Micah chapter 6, and particularly verses 8 through 9. It was the passage that was on the very first bulletin that we had on July 15th, 1980. On the very first bulletin, my wife drew a picture and placed this verse on the front of the bulletin, and it says, "He has shown you, O human, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God?" I love that passage. The three main points that it makes, I think, are relevant to the discussion that we're going to have is, first of all, it asks us to act justly. And so we all know from what we have learned through many of the things that have been in the news recently, but for a much longer period of time, that there are many disadvantages that have been experienced by Indigenous communities throughout their history. And so we haven't always been just in the way that we responded to treaties and in the way that certain things like education and even access to such things as clean water. So that's the first principle. The second one, and you know, people when they hear this verse often think that what the passage is saying is to be merciful. But the passage doesn't say be merciful, even though that's important. What it says is love mercy. That means make the idea of mercy something that you embrace profoundly. And so in our interactions with those who have a different experience maybe than we do, this idea of loving mercy and letting mercy be at the front is very important. And finally, to walk humbly. You know, when we are learning that where we are and what we've experienced does cause hardships for others, it takes a certain amount of humility to be open to learning. And so I've tried to be that in my interactions with Indigenous communities. I've tried to very much learn from them, be a student first, and to share very humbly when I do. I've asked some ridiculous questions. I didn't share this with the first service, but I'll share it with you now. My good friend John Rice, I was his best man at his wedding. We're very close. So I'd be bouncing all these questions off him because I knew very little about what my Indigenous background meant. So I'm hitting him with all these questions. Every so often, I'd see him smile and his eyes would get really small. And over time, I recognized that when he did that, I had just offended him and he was being too kind to tell me, you know, that my question wasn't appropriate, or maybe I was exploring in areas that probably weren't best for me to be doing so. So finally I said to him, John, listen, these things are important to me. I really want to know, but I don't know when I'm saying something that is offensive to you. So when I do, you need to tell me because I can't do better if I don't know better. So you need to tell me when I'm saying something or doing something that is hurtful or harmful. And so he was very kind to do that going forward. But that quality is something I think is important if we're going to engage any individual from a background different than ours, particularly those that may experience a different level of privilege, if I can use that word. We need to be humble and be willing to learn first, be learners first.
I appreciate all of that. Actually, is the mic audio okay, or should you use... Okay, maybe if it's possible, would you be able to grab the wired mic? Just, we're getting some static from the wireless. We want to make sure that people online can hear okay. I appreciate all of that. I guess some of that, it's a biblical response. I just want to make sure I understand. I mean, I've got my ideas as to why, but why should a church, and this church in particular, be talking about this?
Well, first of all, it's a little loud. I'm not sure how many are aware, but we actually, within our district, or what would be our catchment area at Waypoint, have 7 indigenous communities. And so regular engagement with people of indigenous background is a common experience for people in our area. Those who live in the Penetang Midland area probably most often engage those who are from Chimnasing or Christian Island. And so we do have opportunity to include within our own local community members of communities, indigenous communities from Georgina Island all the way up to Moose Deer Point, north of Parry Sound. So I do want to say that what I'm not appealing for when we talk about this today is to ask anybody to stand on a stump and start becoming an advocate for indigenous issues. In fact, this idea of being an ally, you know, I don't get to declare myself an ally of indigenous communities just because I sit with them on the Aboriginal Health Circle, and I am an ally when someone tells me that I am an ally. And so what I've tried to do in my engagement is to, first of all, remain humble and remain a learner. But I have a motto that I use in my role. It touches every aspect of my life, and is do the right thing in the moment each and every time. And so whether or not someone sees my participation as something that creates more trust in me as an ally is entirely secondary. What I'm asking is that when we have opportunities to engage with people around issues that are important to the indigenous communities, and we have an opportunity to have a voice, we do the right thing in the moment each and every time, whatever that is, and let the other piece take care of itself.
All right. Just before we get into some of the specific questions, let's just address something that we want to make sure people are aware of, and that's that Be in Christ Church of Canada, BIC Canada, has had some direct engagement with an Indigenous community in very northern Saskatchewan, something called Timber Bay Children's Home. And if you search that up online, you'd find articles, some of which are questioning the work that happened there, others are not. So there's different perspectives on it, and it's before my time in BIC. You have been there. Could you just speak to kind of what that was?
And So when I was there back in 1982, it was the Montreal Lake Children's Home, and it has transitioned to the name Timber Bay Children's Home sometime in the late 80s. It was originally an operation of the Mennonite churches. And we took over sometime in the late 70s, but it was not a residential school. What happened at Montreal Lake at the time was they had an agreement with a number of indigenous communities in the LaRange, Saskatchewan area to board their children at this location so they could attend day school in the communities, attend high school and elementary school. Because it was a good distance away from where they were able to go to school, and where their communities were. So there were contracts in place that we who ran Montreal Lake and then Timber Bay would provide these services for their kids, and hopefully in a way that also did some surrogate parenting and allowed them to experience love and affection and all of those things that are important, particularly when people are living away from home. So that's what we did. There, to the best of my knowledge, never were any accusations of wrongdoing in terms of the treatment of the children, and there are none being made now by the communities. What they are objecting to is that, you know, consistent with the way evangelicals operated at the time, if you did live at the home, you were expected to sit in on Bible classes and do catechism and things like this. And so against their will, children were made to learn biblical concepts. And so that's the part that they're objecting to now. And some kids found to be disrespectful and traumatic. And I don't doubt that. If you held a certain perspective and you were being force-fed another perspective, that could be, by interpretation, seen as being an abuse of power. And that's kind of what you're reading in the news right now. What I can tell you about the actual facility is that it's about 2 hours or 3 hours north of Prince Albert. When I was there in July, the sun never set. The facility itself was beautiful. It had... I remember floral curtains being on every window. There were nice tablecloths on every table. The bedroom that I stayed in was very clean. It was comfortable. It was well-equipped. So it was a good location for a place to be if you had to be away from home, but home it was not, and parents, they were not.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the unintended impact, you know, as best you can offer, just being away from home for extended periods of time, some of the impact that could have. I want to leave space and time for your questions, but this one big one is really the one that that I wrestle with a lot. It's our tendency to label people as, you know, with stereotypes, or, you know, they're one of them. And they cease to be a human being in the image of God, and they're instead a label. And I hear this, I've heard this in a number of different situations and contexts with Indigenous people. And so I'm just wondering, what are some things that you can share with us to help us see past the various ways that we label them, and in order to help us to see the real people that we're engaging with at any given moment, any given time?
Well, first of all, when it comes to any community of people, there is really no us and them. I mean, within our own church, there'd be more conservative-minded, more liberal-minded people, and we're still one church. You find the same thing within the Indigenous communities. You have those who are very Christian and very attached to a Christian denomination. The two more prominent would be the Roman Catholic and the United Churches, which have invested the most time in developing spiritual relationships from a Christian perspective. But then you have the various traditional spiritual groups. The one I'm most familiar with is the Madewin Three Fires Lodge. Both of the healers that have worked with me have been third-degree Madewin healers, which means they have 30 years of experience and training in doing the rituals and the rites of the Madewin Lodge. But some of the things that John's talking about, as an example, some of the stereotypes that you may have heard, if you live in this area, you probably have heard about alcohol and drug abuse being a big problem on First Nations reservations or communities. And the truth is, I should mention I'm an instructor for the Mental Health Commission of Canada doing mental health first aid, and one of the things that we talk about when we're doing the section on addiction is that statistically the rates of alcoholism and drug abuse in Indigenous communities is lower than it is in the general population. So because there's trauma associated with a lot of Indigenous communities, and because trauma is an historic connection to it as well as an experience of the moment, when people do choose to drink, statistically, they do tend to have higher rates of excessive drinking or drug use when people choose to do that. It's just that people don't choose to do it as often as people who aren't part of those communities think. I think you see the same in all communities. If a person is raised in a home where alcohol has been a problem, where alcoholism has been a problem and there have been abuses associated with the abuse of alcohol, you'll generally see two polarized reactions. You'll have kids who grow up swearing off alcohol and won't touch it at all. And then you have others who see that and, you know, learn from it and use that as a means of dealing with their own pain. And so you see that as well in indigenous communities. And what we need to appreciate about indigenous communities is that there is a strong trauma root that's pretty consistent throughout all indigenous communities, whether they're in Canada or the United States or other parts of the Americas. And that trauma can be generational. And so let me just explain a little bit about how that works. And to use it as an example that I can use as a parallel example, I read an article back in probably 10 years ago that I've referenced quite frequently since about the rates of alcoholism in Muscovy, which is the ancient name for Russia. And what the study that was being written about was doing was looking at the high rates of alcoholism in Russian culture and researching the antecedents to that. And what they found is that because Muscovy, again, the ancient name of Russia, was invaded over and over and over again, and the people experienced huge wiping out of the civilization over and over again, Genghis Khan being one of those individuals who did that, it created all kinds of peripheral problems that have been passed along. So if you can imagine, if you are part of a family where separation has occurred and trauma has happened, so there's distraction in the ability for people to bond as a unit. We know that even from the very earliest parts of life, if there's not a bond that is allowed to occur between a mother and the child, that has impacts going forward and can have significant impacts. So when this happens to entire families, that has an impact on the ability to do healthy attachment. So do all Russian people have attachment problems? No. Statistically, is attachment disorder more common experience among certain groupings in Russia? That's what the study said. Now, when you look at the indigenous communities, because of the 60s scoop where kids were taken out of their homes and placed into foster homes, because of the residential schools where they were taken from their families at a very young age and only allowed to return when they were around 18 or 19 to their communities, stripped of their language and having no opportunity to bond with their families, you have parents, A, who never had that bonding experience, and then children who don't know what it's like to bond with a parent. So that doesn't overcome itself in one generation unless there is an interruption to that and bonding is taught and allowed to be learned. It just gets passed along and along and along. And that's one of the challenges that come with the residential schools. So when we say, yeah, the residential schools, they happened in the late 1800s. It was done by the early 70s. It's not happening now. This shouldn't be having an impact on any. Well, yeah, it does. Because all of those that are involved in that process at any part along that continuum have experienced the deficits that come with that, and some have been very significantly impacted. So here in our area, we had no residential schools. We do have indigenous people who did experience it, who went to residential schools, and have family from other communities that were in residential schools. What we did have here, though, and anybody who's raised in the area will know that indigenous children from Chemnitsing, the Christian Island, Beausoleil First Nation, were billeted in our community in community homes, both here and in Midland. And Austin, who's the current healer that works, Austin Mixamung, was born and raised on Christian Island. And he shares with me his experience of being billeted in Midland and some of the some of the experiences he had to endure. And so there has been trauma associated with that as well. And while there were some indigenous students who had wonderful experiences with really loving, billeting parents who took them in and really nurtured them and made it a pleasant experience, we all know that anytime opportunity to have power over others exists, there are those who will exploit that power, and they did experience that. So we have that in our community as well.
I appreciate just that reflection on generational trauma. Just a lot, we've all been experienced by the experiences of those who've gone before. It's just often we may not be aware of how those messages have been passed down. You know, I worked through some stuff a while ago where, you know, I was trying to figure out why I heard messages that I did from my mom. And then I talked to my mom, and she talks about messages she heard from her mom. And her mom heard them because she lived in an orphanage. And it kind of got passed down, and we weren't aware of it until we actually talked about it. And that's true for me. That's true for each of us that happened. Is there any questions? Just we want to make sure we have time for that. Any questions here in person? Feel free to put your hand up and ask away. Looking online, there's no questions online yet. Yeah?
I've got it feels like an awkward question, but I'll put it out there anyway, because I think you two are would be wonderful to answer it. Or to sort of start to address it, because I don't think there's a necessary definite answer. What is your response to the idea of privileging different, I'm going to use the word oppressed, I don't know if that's the best adjective, but groups, when we look at the work done by, in this case, Black Lives Matter, and the somewhat quieter response for Black Canadians, versus, and again, I'm uncomfortable with that, Joyner, but whoever's Indigenous versus other minority.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and thank you for asking it. Do you want to repeat it?
So I just want to make sure I repeat it for those who are online and make sure we understand it. So what's our how do we think about the privileging of perhaps one group that's faced challenges over other groups that have faced challenges, specifically, you know, an emphasis on Indigenous people in Canada as opposed to people who've experienced lives as Black people here in Canada and in the States, you know, emphasizing perhaps Black Lives Matter over some other. Was that okay?
So, number of layers to that. So, to the question of, you know, how do you separate out the groups? Let me start with that one. We know that the baseline perspective that informs Black Lives Matter, that makes it important for that to be looked at by the larger community, is that following the Civil War, when they were trying to decide how they were going to handle the fact that now the slaves were free and were going to be integrated into American society, and by the way, I'm American and Canadian. I did most of my education down south and only a couple years of it up here. They came up with what's known as the Three-Fifths Compromise. And what the Three-Fifths Compromise meant is that if you were not a white person, if you were indeed a former slave, you were worth three-fifths of a human being, which allowed them to make Jim Crow laws, which disadvantaged Black people and kept them from progressing and replacing us as the current lingo. So if you ask, are there people who are part of that conversation who are going over the top? Yeah, certainly there are. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Here in Canada, many of you would not know. If you've probably heard about residential schools, you probably haven't heard of Indian hospitals, because we didn't have them in Ontario. But in BC, they had Indian hospitals. And so they were separate institutions that people who were Indigenous were sent to when they needed care. And in those hospitals, there were experiments done on them that would rival the Nazis for what they did during World War II. The horrendous abuses done against individuals in the so-called Indian hospitals. So there are just layers of trauma that they don't even talk about that inform their opinions. My friend John Rice, that I mentioned, we both have type 2 diabetes. And so back in the 2000s, we agreed with one another. We were going to walk 5 kilometers a day, and we were going to power walk. We were going to do this at the top of our pace. We'd get up in the morning before work, and we'd do it, and we'd hold each other accountable to it when we got in. I did that. I still do it. I have never once been stopped by the police. John gets stopped every couple of weeks when he does that, because he's out in the morning looking very much like an indigenous person and experiencing that disadvantage. So to the second part of that, the idea of privilege and how we are supposed to handle that if we're part of a majority community. So let me take it from the racial piece, which is easy to become defensive about, and place it into something that very strongly affects everyone in this room. So when we talk about equal rights for women and equal pay for equal work and those kinds of things, right now in Fortune 500 companies, how many of the Fortune 500 companies do you think have females as the CEO and president? 3. So let me ask you, do you think that only 3 women that are competing with the men that are part of these companies, do you think that there just are only 3 women that can compete and have that qualification and that ability? No. When we know that there's been 1 woman as a prime minister in Canada, Kim Campbell, and that was, 3 months? And we have never had a U.S. president that's female, and only now have our first vice president down there who happens to be female. Do you think that there have been no women qualified to be prime minister of Canada or president of the United States, or are all the men so much better at thinking and doing that, you know? Or is it because being a man has certain privileges that comes along with it that gives them an advantage in the workplace? So when we talk about white privilege, and the fact that when you're a white male living in Canada or in the United States, that certain opportunities come to you that other people have to fight for. I know that I've applied in my life for dozens of jobs, and I've never walked into one of them worrying that my race or my gender was going to work against me. But I'll guarantee that anybody who walks into even the organization I work for at Waypoint, who is not representing the majority of this area, is going to be worried that they're going to come in with just as many qualifications and not get as much consideration. So does the idea of getting privilege based on having certain characteristics exist? Yes, it absolutely does. So if I can transition that then away from that to Indigenous communities, when we know that there are communities that exist, ours doesn't necessarily fit this profile when it comes to the water problem. There are still many, many communities in Canada where Indigenous people cannot get clean water. They've been boiling it for decades, and we've not solved that problem. Do you think that there would be any single one regular, non-residential community that would not have clean water in Canada? But that they have not gotten the same attention when it comes to things like that. So if they say there's a privilege that comes to being part of the non-Indigenous community, we can say, well, there's certainly a privilege where that's concerned. When you look at the educational system, where, you know, children that are in non-Indigenous schools go in and you have a teacher that's required to have gotten a degree and taken teacher's college and having, that's not necessarily the same. When you go on to the Indigenous communities, they will take individuals who are able to teach but have really no background in teaching, because that's what their funding allows them to do, because the funding is not equal. So when we talk about privilege, what we're trying to recognize is that, you know, when I as a, and I get the benefit of every single bit of it, as a white male living in Canada, I have to be aware of that when I'm interacting with somebody who's not seeing the world the same as me based on the fact they have not had those same advantages. So as a Christian, I try to keep that in mind. And if you just use the axiom, you know, what would Jesus do? I'm pretty sure Jesus wouldn't take advantage of his privilege, and as he showed many times throughout his ministry, he would be for the underdog or the downtrodden. So again, I'm not asking anyone to stand on a stump. I'm giving you information that I hope will help you to appreciate why there is emphasis on things like white privilege. Do white people grate and recoil when they hear that? Yeah, many probably do, because it sounds like an indictment against us as if we're doing something wrong for being white, right? But what it really is, it's saying, hey, there are advantages that come to certain people that do not come to us, and nobody's listening, and every time an agreement gets made, it's been broken, and you know, the whole truth and reconciliation piece that they're trying to work through in Canada is basically trying to get us to take a look at what's gone on in the past, allowing that to inform the decisions that we're making in the present, hopefully to help create the possibility of a better future. So that's a long bit of rambling around that question. I hope it was at least helpful in some ways.
I think the other part of your question was like comparing this group versus that group and our elevation of, hey, let's try and make things right over here, and we may not care or seem like we care as much about making things right over here. Is that correct? And to that, specifically with the two groups that you mentioned in terms of black people in Canada and Indigenous people in Canada, their experiences are different. And so I guess rather than trying to compare this versus that, I would hope that we could come to a place where we are willing to listen to what different people's experiences are, rather than being an advocate for this and not an advocate for that. Like Glenn said, like, you know, my job is primarily not to be an advocate. It's to be a person who seeks to love well in the name of Jesus and listen and like listening well. And when someone is expressing their struggle, to heed that as opposed to push back and say, yeah, well, that kind of pushback response. So I don't really have much to say in terms of like, you know, societally, why do we do this and not that? That's bigger than I feel comfortable responding to. But I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there are different areas of trauma and challenge and experience with different people based on their experience.
One of my roles at Waypoint is I'm responsible for the portfolio around diversity. So I've been to every single program talking about diversity issues that don't just impact Indigenous communities, but all the various, because at Waypoint we see the world, both in our patient population and in our employee base. It's not just one thing. But I think the reason why Indigenous issues are getting more attention right now, finding the hidden residential school issues has elevated it. So that certainly has given opportunity for us to look at that. There's a lot of support between Black Lives Matter, even in Canada, and those that are part of Indigenous groups that are trying to gain some justice in the way that these issues are treated. So for us, I think the reason why it's important for us to have this conversation is that, yes, we have to be just and think of our privilege and use those lenses that I've been talking about when we engage anyone who's different. And, you know, I've been particularly moved by what's happening in our Asian communities these days, with the reaction to the issue in Wuhan and the blaming of the Chinese for problems around COVID-19 and all of that. It's just had horrendous impacts on those communities. But I just want to emphasize, again, that we are within 2 hours of 7 Indigenous communities in our area. And the Beausoleil First Nation is right here among us. And so that is a large community that has experienced a lot of the things that we've been describing, with whom we have opportunity to allow ourselves to be a conduit of the grace and the love of Christ. And I want to go back to the idea. I'm not asking anyone to stand on a stump, and I hope you don't think that's what I'm doing. I don't get opportunity to share these things every day. I'm pleased to be able to share some of my own experience with it. What I try to do is when a situation, and often you can't even anticipate, you just find yourself in a moment where there's something in you that says, this is a moment for courage. This is where I have to be willing to maybe go a little against the grain. What I've done is I've just stuck with facts. Like when I hear someone say something about a drunken Indian or whatever the case may be, I will say, you know, it's interesting you should say that. Did you know that rates of alcoholism in indigenous communities are lower than they are in the general population? That's actually a statistical fact. So I try to address the misgiving in the moment. I didn't share this with this group yet, so I think I will, because I want you to know that the idea of the name Indian does not come from Christopher Columbus having wrongly identified the population when he landed. It was a name given to the indigenous people of South America by the Spanish, and it comes from Indios, which means of God. And what they found is that the indigenous people were a very spiritual people, so they referenced them as the people of God. And so that's why many indigenous people don't object to the use of the word Indian. It's in their way of looking at it, it's almost complimentary. But having said that, I take my cue on whether a person's comfortable with that phrase based on the person. Austin uses it all the time. John doesn't. You can't predict based on one human being what every other person is going to think. So, but anyway, that is the background behind the word, the phrase Indian.
I think that brings us back to, we need to wrap up, but that idea that we work hard to see individuals as people created in the image of God, not representative of all of an entire group, just as, quite frankly, there are a lot of people who bear the name Christian out there that I don't want people looking at and saying, oh, that's what a Christian is. I get deeply offended by that. We shouldn't do this with anyone.
Yes.
And so with this, chances are good. Those of us who live in this community are going to be interacting at some point with indigenous people or with other people who have attitudes towards indigenous people based on stereotypes. And so the invitation is to just to be conscious of our own biases that we may have had unconsciously, to be aware of the desire to see each person as someone created in the image of God, and to work hard to try and love those people well, not because we will ever do it perfectly, but because we're supposed to be people who are representing the love of Jesus to everyone. You had something else you wanted to add? The only other thing I will add before we wrap up is just maybe use this as a chance to consider some of the messages that you've been told in the past about, you know, some of the stuff that you've inherited and have brought with you to today. I know Glenn talked in the first service about his, you know, about your experience growing up as a Catholic. Why don't you just mention that, just because I think that's helpful just to get ourselves thinking.
Yeah, what I was sharing in the first service was the idea of imprinting that comes with having been conditioned in a certain manner. And, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic. And when I left Catholicism and adopted more of the Anabaptist mindset, as one who was taught that it was a sin to eat meat on Friday, I still felt guilty eating meat on Friday for a lot longer than, you know, it took my mind to say this is not a necessary thing, right? That my mind knew I didn't need to worry about it. My conditioning told me something else. And, you know, I was, you know, people have been taught that wearing makeup or dancing is wrong, and you learn, no, there's really nothing biblically wrong with either one of those things. Still doesn't mean that you would not feel a measure of guilt doing something that your conditioning said was something that you weren't supposed to be doing. So it's kind of hard to escape your early conditioning, whatever it is. And just because you know better doesn't mean it feels any different. I mean, just think of, if you don't mind me saying so, think of the concept of masturbation, which has caused more guilt and shame in Christian communities than probably any other single concept. Not one word about it in the Bible, just a misplaced reference to a man named Onan who failed to raise up seed for his brother, which had nothing to do with masturbation, but it's been used for that. And so we have a bunch of kids growing up, responding to their bodies in the way that kids are going to respond, feeling guilt and shame over it because we've taught them that this is a sin, right? So anyway, that's a more elaborate explanation than I gave in the first one.
Yeah, that wasn't in the script, Glenn.
Yeah.
But I think it's a
relatable human example.
But I would say just as we become aware of that stuff with us, it helps us to be open to how that could be true in someone else as well, and helps to bridge that the divides of the us versus them, and helps us to see each other as whole people in the image of God.